Hello, and welcome to the second installment of Leaders in Lowell's new virtual discussion series.
Today we are joined by Peggy Grandy, who served as President Ronald Reagan's executive assistant from 1989 to 1999. She's also the author of the book, The President Will See You Now, of her time working with President Reagan.
We hope you enjoy the discussion.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Leaders in Lowell's virtual discussion series. Today we are fortunate enough to be joined by Peggy Grandy. Peggy, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your career?
Of course. So I consider myself to be one of the luckiest women in the world. I had the opportunity of a lifetime to serve as the executive assistant to President Ronald Reagan for 10 years. I started working for him when I was a college student and then was hired to be full-time staff. And what an incredible decade of my life. I never could have imagined, but as a young person, to have a front row seat to history, of course, it changed the trajectory of my life forever.
Would you be able to give us a bit more insight into kind of how you got started in the office of Ronald Reagan?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to. So I was kind of always one of those nerdy little kids that loved presidents and politics and history and government. And I don't know why, it was just my fascination. And I grew up in Southern California, so it might as well have been a million miles from Washington, D.C. But somehow I was captivated by that world and read every book I could possibly get my hands on. Every paper I ever wrote was about a president or a first lady. And then I went to college. And when I was in college, I was a communications major. And wouldn't you know it, but the great communicator himself was in the White House, Ronald Reagan. And so every report I did, every speech I studied in my communications classes, of course, always went back to Reagan, so much that I think my professors eventually said, okay, can you write about somebody else? But in Ronald Reagan, I found this perfect convergence of everything I loved. He was a man of faith and values and principles. He was a man of optimism and patriotism, and he painted a picture for America that we all believed and bought into and wanted to be part of. And so I watched this for 8 years. You know, I remember clearly the moment he was shot and how devastating that was. I think I was in junior high at the time, but had followed his career even as a very young person and never imagined I would have the chance to interact with the political arena at all. My family, we were a family of educators. Nobody was politically connected. We weren't of the donor class. And so I never saw a pathway for that, which is even when I went to college, I was not a political science major. I was a communications major because I thought, it's not very practical probably to do politics because what does a career in politics look like? But as I was getting ready to graduate from college, Ronald Reagan left the White House and opened an office in Southern California in LA, not too far from where I was finishing school. So I heard that he was coming back to LA, and my dad had raised me to believe that somebody's got to have the job you want and it might as well be you. So I took a chance and wrote a letter. You know, back in the day, it was probably on an old school typewriter, licked a stamp, stuck it in the mail, mailed it off to the office of Ronald Reagan, never expecting that I would ever even get a phone call or an interview, let alone have an opportunity to work there. So you can imagine my surprise when the phone rang and it was a woman from the office of Ronald Reagan inviting me in for an interview. And I was terrified and thrilled, but I knew if I just got a chance to set foot on the floor of that office, it would be the most exciting day of my life. So I'm glad that chance paid off. I went in for an interview. In fact, I tell a very embarrassing story about my interview in my book. But the interview went well. I was hired basically on the spot for what I thought would be a short-term internship as I was graduating from college in my last semester. But at the end of that, I was hired to work for the chief of staff as his executive assistant and served in that capacity for a few years. And then at a couple years in, Ronald Reagan's longtime executive assistant he had had since before he was governor retired, and they asked me to take that role. So you don't say no to a job opportunity like that, but I was 6 months pregnant with my first baby and wasn't quite sure how I was going to navigate that whole space, but I stayed working for President Mrs. Reagan. I worked for them for 10 years. I got married. I had 3 of my 4 children while I was working for him. So in a lot of ways, not only did my children grow up with Ronald Reagan, but I feel like I grew up with Ronald Reagan. as well, and was such a privilege and a pleasure to be connected to them, not only through the end of my time serving him, but through the end of his life, to go to visit him in his home and to stay connected with Mrs. Reagan really until her passing in 2016. So 27 years of my life, I was so fortunate to be connected to President and Mrs. Reagan.
And in your book, you talk about how you worked with President Reagan on a daily basis for such a long time, and how your kids really got to know President and Mrs. Reagan, and how the Reagans got to see them grow up. So we were wondering what it was really like to see how you got to know him as a leader and as a man on two different levels.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was this familiarity because it was somebody that I worked with closely every day, but there was always this formality as well. You never lost that feeling of, this man was president of the United States. And so there was this combination of this awe, kind of those pinch me moments where you think, how on earth does a girl like me wind up in a place like this? There was hundreds of those over the course of 10 years, but also the warmth and the way that Mrs. Reagan and President Reagan welcomed me and my children into their home and into their lives was something that really put us at ease. You never completely get comfortable with that, but my kids grew up very comfortable with President and Mrs. Reagan. I was always very nervous taking them up to the president's house, you know, this beautiful home full of all these incredible pieces, and just, you know, kids don't touch, just look, you know, a little bit nervous, but they were always warm and welcoming. And so while it was a very familiar part of our day and of our life, you certainly never lost that feeling of this man was really something special. And even now looking back on those years, in the midst of it, I obviously knew he was a remarkable man and that he had changed the course of history. But I think now even with the perspective of time, we look back and he was not only a great, he was a giant among greats. And history has looked back on him so favorably that it really even amplifies the experiences of those years and makes me even more grateful for that chance.
Well, that's obviously amazing. And I mean, so did your kids take any of those lessons that they learned with them, and did you, and implement them in their own lives then and now?
Yeah, it's really interesting because actually one of my daughters took a speech class in college, and she said one of the speeches that they listened to, they didn't even watch the audio, I mean the video, but they listened to the audio of President Reagan giving a speech. And she said, "Mom, when I heard his voice, it just made me feel safe." And I thought, what an interesting comment. And obviously for her, she had the context of knowing that voice and hearing that from her memories personally. But I think in general, Ronald Reagan gave us that feeling and that perspective when he was president that we were safe, that he was going to make decisions that were the best for our nation and that would be based in wisdom and great advisors. And we felt safe with his decision-making. So I thought, you know, as a young adult, how interesting to have that be the takeaway. But I really think in a way he did make us feel safe. And it's interesting because I travel the nation and internationally as well. And I speak a lot about Ronald Reagan and I talk about leadership and what it looks like at the highest and best. And certainly he was such a great example of that. But especially when I speak across the nation, inevitably I'll be telling stories and I'll look out in the audience and there's people crying. And, you know, at first when I started speaking, I thought, is this okay? are these happy tears? What is this? But he evokes this emotional response in people. And when I really thought about it, I think it's, yes, we loved and admired and respected him, especially those of us who were politically aligned with him. But I think it's even bigger than that. I think it's that we loved ourselves as Americans. We loved who we were on the world stage. We were proud of the fact that we were bold in shining a torch of freedom all over the globe, wherever oppression existed. And so I think it's bigger than one man. He made us believe in ourselves and look at America in an entirely different way. And he did it starting on day one. And especially as a communications major, I love looking at how he used communication to change the minds of a nation. And you guys, of course, are far too young to remember the 1970s. But if you read anything about the 1970s, taxes were high, inflation was high, unemployment was high, and worst of all, American morale was incredibly low. It was the era of malaise. Ronald Reagan gets elected, and on day one of his presidency, in his inaugural speech, he's talking about themes like, it's morning in America, There's a new dawn ahead. There's a shining city on a hill, and we all get to be part of it. America's best days are yet ahead. And in reality, on day one of his presidency, America was no different. Taxes were high, inflation was high. You know, the circumstances of America were exactly the same. But he completely changed our mind about the capacity for what we could be together by changing the language. And certainly during the course of his presidency over the next 8 years, he implemented tax cuts and regulation repeals and things that helped. But it was that language initially that reminded us that we could be more than the circumstances of today. And so I think people loved and appreciated that about him. And then at the end of his presidency, if you would have asked him what he was most proud of, he always said it wasn't about the policies, it wasn't about the things that he had done, which a lot of us thought were historic, but he said, I made the American people believe in themselves again. And that was the greatest gift and legacy that Ronald Reagan could have left us after his 8 years. He really did make us believe in ourselves again and have the capacity to once again innovate and expand and grow our businesses and invest in this great nation and put people back to work. And so that was something he was always very proud of.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. He did leave the nation with a lot of good memories and things like that. And people obviously reflect fondly upon that. What are some of your favorite memories that you have from both working with him and knowing him personally?
Yeah. You know, there were several. So I would say there was two facets to the job. And looking back, especially when I went to write my book, a lot of people said, oh, did you keep a diary? And as much as I wish I would have, because it would have been a nice little crutch, I guess, to have, it really would have been, I guess, if you keep a diary, it'd be more about where you went, who you saw, what you did. Maybe a little bit about what you feel, but when I stopped and really reflected on those years, what I had to dig deep for was, so what did it all mean? And what was the meaning after 10 years of serving at the feet of this great man? And, you know, I never thought I would write a book because I wasn't sure that it's appropriate. You know, with proximity comes this feeling of confidentiality and privacy, and you never want to betray that. But I was speaking at a conference a couple of years ago, and I had a man approach me who said, oh, Peggy, you have to tell your story in book format. And this was a man who runs a presidential history program out of one of the big universities. And I kind of pushed back and said, I don't think I ever would. I don't think it's appropriate. And he said something that completely changed my mind. He said, if there was a woman who sat outside Abraham Lincoln's office door every day for 10 years, don't you think that we would want to know what she saw, what she learned, and don't you think she would owe it to history to tell us? And so when I was reflecting back on those years, yes, there were those big moments, but I really think the beauty of who he was in, if you could ever call them ordinary days in the office, where this extraordinary man lived a very ordinary life and had a very ordinary person outside his office serve him and find together this unusual partnership of getting things done and making things happen and continuing with the legacy that he had created throughout his life. And so it was those ordinary days, I think, that really revealed who he was. You know, people always ask, was he really what we thought and hoped that he was? And I would say he's one of the few people that if you met him in person, he was even better than you had ever imagined that he was. And I'm sure for you guys, you may have had, you know, heroes in sports or music or people you've been fans of. And if you ever have a chance to meet them, sometimes they're a little disappointing because you think they're not quite what I thought or hoped that they were. Well, Ronald Reagan was the exact opposite, and whatever pedestal you had put him on in your mind, when you met him, he was kinder and more gracious and warm and welcoming than even you could have imagined. And so those moments to see behind the scenes where there was no disconnect between his public persona and his private persona really reinforced the goodness and the greatness of this man. And like I said, history will look back on him with great fondness because of that. And I guess as a young person, one of the things that stood out for me is, I guess when I was young, I thought you had to choose. And there was one of two paths in life. You either had to be strong and successful, or you had to be a nice person. But you couldn't possibly be both. And in Ronald Reagan, and especially seeing him behind the scenes and interacting with him so closely and personal on a daily basis, I saw that you could be both. And he navigated both lanes with such great success. Nobody argues that he was strong. I mean, he went toe-to-toe with the Soviet Union. He went to the Brandenburg Gate and he challenged Gorbachev to tear down the wall. And by the way, two years later, that wall did come down. And so nobody underestimated his resolve and his strength, but behind that was this beautiful humanity as well. And there was a softness and a gentleness to him. And he loved people and he loved people of all kinds. You didn't have to be a king or a president for him to give you his full respect. He loved meeting everyday American people who had written into him and asked for the opportunity to meet him. And so to see those beautiful moments, and I write about a lot of them in my book, but those behind the scenes moments were really special. And so that was kind of one part of the role, was those behind the scenes, very private moments when the cameras weren't rolling, when he thought nobody was watching. I was always watching. And so what did I see? How did that change my life? And how did that reaffirm everything that I had always imagined that he was? The other side of that was the very public facing. And so big public events and star-studded lineups and black tie dinners and things like that, that really were the presidential side that you think of, the pomp and circumstances of being with somebody like that out in public. And you can imagine, we would step foot into any public space and go from the solitude and the quiet and the security of the office, step out into any public space, even just the lobby of the building. And he always had Secret Service protection, but people would swarm him and want to talk to him and shake his hand and get an autograph. And there was just this throng of people who were dying to see him, talk to him, shake his hand, touch him, interact with him in any way. And so that every day that we experienced that just reconfirmed to me how fortunate I was to really have that front row seat to history, to be able to see this man that the world revered and to feel that surge of interest every time you stepped into the public eye. And so those star-studded moments, those pinch me moments where we're driving in Secret Service-driven motorcades through intersection-controlled streets and flying private planes when I was very young and stepping into these screaming crowds of people who loved him and wanted to hear from him. I'd say that was the other side of that coin, was that very public-facing side that the world saw, and that then I got to have just a front row seat to experience that right alongside with him as well. But there was a lot of pressure, as you can imagine, in a scenario like that. I mean, he's counting on you to have crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's and make sure that everything from the format of the program is set to the vetting of people who are going to meet him backstage to working closely with Secret Service, because always his security was the number one priority for us. But at the same time, we wanted him to be accessible and be able to interact with people. And so always finding that nice little balance between security and accessibility to people who wanted to see him.
So two of my like favorite leaders of all time in history, because I'm big into politics and history, are Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, which Bridget knows because I talk about them constantly. And I believe you met Thatcher. So I have to ask kind of what was it like to meet Thatcher and Gorbachev, who are one of the giants of world history? And how did that kind of impact you behind the scenes?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, it's one of those surreal moments. I mean, you almost feel like you're in an SNL skit and you think, could this even be real that I'm standing here next to Gorbachev or me, Margaret Thatcher? Because as a lover of history myself, I mean, these were iconic world leaders and these people had changed the face and the trajectory of world history forever. And yet they were ordinary people. And, you know, especially Margaret Thatcher, obviously she speaks English as her primary language. Gorbachev always had to work through an interpreter. And so even though there was a relationship there, it wasn't quite the same, obviously, as his with Margaret Thatcher. But to see Ronald Reagan interact with Margaret Thatcher was funny. Nobody has any idea how hysterically funny she was. And so she and President Reagan would kind of goat each other a little bit and tease each other a little bit. And she knew exactly what to say and how to say it to get the president to laugh. And so she would sit there very proper and say something that was hysterically funny. And so she would have this deadpan straight face and the president would be laughing hysterically. And so to be able to watch these behind the scene exchanges and to see that these were real people, and that really when it comes down to it, politics is all personal. And when you strip away the rhetoric of talking points, it all comes down to relationships. And so he and Margaret Thatcher were incredibly successful together on the world stage because they had a relationship that was strong and unified. And we know certainly they went toe to toe. She was not very happy with him sometimes, and he with her, but together they were unified in those global principles that really unified them beyond all their differences. And if you look specifically at Margaret Thatcher, at Ronald Reagan, and I would even add in Pope John Paul II, you know, this triad of influence and power that was on the world stage during that time that really put pressure to collapse the communist system. Ronald Reagan never took credit for that. He certainly was an influential player, but he and Margaret Thatcher really, in a lot of ways, changed the course of history, not only for their countries, but for the world. And so it was surreal being in those moments. With Gorbachev, the same. I mean, the first time I met him, he walks towards you, he sticks out his hand to introduce himself, and he really does have a big red birthmark on his head, and you can't help but look and say, oh, wow, you really are Gorbachev. So it's sort of indescribable, but at the same time, when those meetings were taking place, I had a job to do. And so I needed to be on point and on task and not only lost in the moment and appreciating the gravity of that moment, but I had a job to do. And I couldn't be so lost in the moment that I wasn't thinking 5-10 steps ahead, because watching the clock, when do we need to move? Where do they need to be? When is the media, you know, avail happening, and where do they need to be? And then sometimes interjecting myself and saying, excuse me, I hate to break this up, but we're going to have to move because we need to stay on time with the schedule. And so things like that. So I have kind of these snapshots in my mind that I go to, but at the moment I had to very intentionally take those snapshots in my mind because my mind was racing about what was next and was everything covered, and, you know, just very standing still in the moment, taking it in, but my mind was racing a million miles a minute, thinking about what was next and just wanting it to be right. There's no margin for error when you're dealing with people like that. And so the pressure's on and you want to get it right and you want to capture those moments. So incredibly special, whether it was black tie dinners or up at the ranch, both of them came up to the ranch as well. And so to see them even more casual and sort of Gorbachev riding around in the back of President Reagan's Jeep was like a funny moment where you think, is this really happening? When Gorbachev was coming up to the ranch, President Reagan asked me to find a cowboy hat to give him as a gift. And so it turned into this big quest, because how on earth do you figure out what size hat Gorbachev wears? And this was back in the day before you could Google it or even send an email. I'm sorry, now you're going to think I'm 100 years old. But back in the day, we had to be really creative about how we got things like that done. And so staying late at night, 10 o'clock at night, call Moscow at 8 o'clock in the morning to try to find somebody who spoke enough English to understand what I was asking. I eventually sent a fax with a little picture drawn of a cowboy hat with a question mark and an arrow. And, you know, eventually I got a number back, but it was 60 something, which is not a hat size. So then had to convert a Russian hat size to a Western hat size, again, without the opportunity to do so online. And then finding a cowboy hat in LA itself was an effort in and of itself. But to be there that moment when Reagan presents the hat to Gorbachev, Gorbachev puts it on his head. I'm very proud of myself because the hat fit perfectly. And so I'm kind of patting myself on the back until the next morning when Stetson called and said, we love the fact that our hat was featured so prominently on Gorbachev's head, but did you know he put the hat on backwards? I'm not a cowgirl. I don't know these things. He put the hat on backwards, but.
That's just incredible to be able to meet and just interact with all these huge world leaders on this as your job.
Teresa came to the office as well, and that was a really special moment because you see this very humble, very small of stature woman, and you picture all the places she's walked and all the people she has served, and to be able to look at her hands that were weathered and her feet that you could just picture walking the dry, dusty streets that were sewer infested in Calcutta, and think about all the people whose lives she had impacted, and to watch her interact with President Mrs. Reagan was another one of those moments. And now she's a saint. So I've not only met presidents and prime ministers, but a saint as well. And it really is surreal, but I'm so grateful for that opportunity to be able to witness those things, and then to have the opportunity so many years later to share those in book form, so that the world has a chronicle of things that they never would have seen otherwise. Because post-presidency, it's very different. Things aren't required to be recorded or archived like they are during the presidency, and so there really was a lot of void in those post-presidency years as far as the historical perspective. You know, a lot of people think he left office, he got Alzheimer's, he died, but there was 15 years in there. And so what did those 15 years look like? And I served him for the first 10 of those, from the time he left office until the time he left the public eye. And, you know, what were those years like? What did he do with that platform that he had globally? What did that look like in his private years behind the scenes? And so I tried to tell that story in a way that was revealing, but ultimately very respectful. And I hope that anybody who reads my book will find that I navigated that and towed that line very carefully, talking about those final years, which were incredibly difficult. But it was something the Reagans had chosen to talk about publicly, so I felt like it was fair for me to talk about it as well. But to show the beauty of his life that continued even after he left the White House.
So with everything going on right now, the coronavirus pandemic, we thought we would look back at some of the quotes from President Reagan. And we found one that he said, he said, "Never let the things you can't do stop you from doing what you can." We thought that was really poignant for this moment that we're living through right now. So how do you think that President Reagan would have led in a situation as chaotic and unprecedented as this? And why do you think that's needed, like, now more than ever?
Yeah. Ronald Reagan always had a way of taking something catastrophic and negative and turning it into something positive, and not in a Pollyanna-ish way, glossing over things and minimizing it or ignoring the severity or the gravity of the moment. But he always had a way of believing in America, believing in our opportunity to lead on the world stage. I can picture him as leading a global coalition that would be in support of people everywhere in the world that were suffering under the weight of this. I see him as investing in America, in the American people, reminding them that we're stronger than this, and it's very unprecedented for now, but history has seen some terrible things happen in the past, and we as Americans have always survived them and come out stronger on the other end. And so I think he would have been infusing us with that characteristic optimism. He would have been reaching across political aisles. He would have been reaching across the world to partner with people who were aligned, but I also think he would have been strong, and he would have said that there needs to be investigations into this and there needs to be consequences. You know, even when he was approaching communism and talking to Gorbachev, there was a lot of fear that he was going to start World War III and that his stance was too controversial or too confrontational. And people warned him that he should never say that line that he said at the Berlin Wall. His speech writers took it out. His State Department advisors said it was too confrontational, but he knew that it was what needed to be done and needed to be said. And for the sake of history, aren't we glad that he did? And so I can see him finding that perfect balance between the strength of standing up to tyrants all over the world, standing up to oppression, and building a beautiful global alliance of people who are aligned in values and in principles and who want the world to be successful and prosperous and safe. And so I definitely see him, he would have been at the forefront of that, although I'm always very careful not to put words in his mouth, but we know from history and from precedent, the way he tackled crisis in the past, that he would have not run from it, he would have run into it and led us to a place of pride in our country and of a better future for the world.
Right. So shifting gears a little bit, we also found another quote from him saying, "I've come to believe there is little, if any, honesty in the media, and ethics is a word they are totally unfamiliar with." So what do you think about the way the media behaves today and the attacks on the media from both citizens and those in public office across the political spectrum?
Yeah. Well, being in the media arena is tough. You know, every single word you say is parsed and scrutinized. My biggest concern right now with, I would say, media in general, is that we've kind of blurred the lines between opinion journalism and fact reporting. And so regardless of which channel you go to, there should be a clear distinction between this is an opinion show or this is actually a news story. And we've blurred that lines. And so a lot of news stories are now infused with personal opinion, but presented in the way as if it's news. And so it requires a level of sophistication and a critical eye for consumers of media to check their sources, to listen with an ear that is thinking about that in comparison to what they know and what they believe. And, you know, I consume a wide range of media and I suggest that everybody should. And, you know, if you've heard somebody's terrible because they're so extreme one way or the other, listen to them and listen to them for yourself. But that's my biggest concern, is that we've blurred that line between opinion journalism and news journalism. And it's imperative, especially now, to be able to separate out facts from opinion. And we don't see a lot of that happening. And so I think that's why we see numbers of, you know, consumer confidence in everything from Congress to news outlets historically low, because they're trying to peddle, in a lot of circumstances, peddle opinion as fact. And the consumer sees through that, but then they don't know where to go to actually get facts. So, you know, I don't like to compare any two presidents, but I will say that Donald Trump, in a lot of ways, is taking a page out of the Reagan playbook by going directly to the American people, and with his message and with the things that he wants to say. Obviously, Donald Trump does it on Twitter, and now he's doing it with these daily briefings. But back in the day, Ronald Reagan did it through weekly radio addresses, through calling the cameras into the Oval Office and saying that he wanted to speak to the nation, and he would look into the camera and come right into your living room and bypass the media, bypass the pundits, and come directly to you as the American people and have straight talk. And we need leaders who are willing to say truth and willing to believe that we as Americans can handle the truth, even when it's something that we don't want to hear. If it's scary or if it's frightening, or if it's concerning, we can handle the truth together and to provide a pathway forward. And I think that that's what we need to get back to, is straight talk, factual talk, and really being able to then disseminate between, just, you know, determine the difference between fact and opinion. And so I think that's a dangerous thing. And for you guys, especially as young people, you're so inundated with information, but learning to find wisdom amidst the information is going to be your ongoing challenge.
So I'm a big fan of British politics. Brexit, I have a Vote Leave poster right there on my wall. And so I found out about your book by listening to Christopher Hope's Chopper's Brexit podcast, where I learned about World for Brexit. And so I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what World for Brexit is and was, and why I thought it was so important to get involved in an issue that's as consequential as Britain leaving the EU.
Yeah. Well, as we know, Ronald Reagan was a freedom fighter. And so I think that that was infused in me all the years that I worked for him. And so, you know, like most people, I watched the Brexit vote happen in 2016, and it was this historic vote. And we, you know, all the pundits had said it's never going to happen. The people aren't going to go for it. They're not going to vote for it. And we saw a historic turnout, and we saw that the people actually did vote to leave the European Union. And so, like most elections that happen in democracies around the world, we think that the people voted, it's going to be implemented. And so here comes 2017, and here comes 2018, and all of a sudden you're realizing that the will of the people is not being implemented. And in fact, this was a leave country that had voted to leave the European Union, but they had a remain parliament, and parliament was dragging their feet and stalling at every turn, not wanting for the will of the people to be considered. And so if we had seen that anyplace else in the world, Venezuela, Cuba, Zimbabwe, there would have been this sense of global outrage. You know, how dare the leaders not respect the will of the people? But we heard crickets on the world stage about the people of the UK voting to leave the EU and then their own parliament not being willing to implement the will of the people. And so enter World for Brexit. There was a group of us that got together and said, we have got to shine a spotlight on this egregious breach of democracy. And we have got to show the people in the UK that voted to leave the European Union that we believe in them, we stand behind them, we support them, and we wanted to defend their right to freedom and liberty. Because if we could allow something like that to happen in one of the longest standing democracies in the world, it could happen anywhere. And so free-minded people, liberty lovers all around the world then started uniting behind this group called World for Brexit. We had partners in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, India, Israel, all over the world saying, yes, we want you to know that we stand with you. We stand on the side of liberty and freedom and democracy. We see the threat that's taking place there in your country. And we're concerned about it because if it can happen there, we know it can happen here too. So it was a fascinating project to jump into the middle of. I started out as just being the spokesperson for World for Brexit, and then they asked me to chair it. And what an incredible opportunity to work with the Conservative Party in the UK, to work with Nigel Farage personally as well, and so many great Brexiteers all over the UK as well as the European Union. And we see, and we're seeing now, especially even in this coronavirus pandemic, supranational organizations do not work. We need nationalism, we need that national pride, we need the ability to control our own immigration system, to control our courts, to make decisions that benefit our people. And in the UK, we saw that the United Kingdom was getting lost in this bureaucracy of the European Union. And there's no reason why the people in the UK should have to surrender their allegiance both to Westminster and to Brussels. They, in essence, had no voice and no representation there, because if you know anything about the European Union, even the representatives that are the members of parliament there are basically, they don't have a voting voice. They have a voice of influence, but they don't, at the end of the day, make the final decisions. And so there's this unelected body that is not accountable to the voters, that is making decisions that affect every aspect of British life. And so fast forwarding, Boris Johnson is elected, and what a historic vote that was. And we're, of course, so glad that he's recovering personally from the coronavirus pandemic. But to watch him step into leadership, to watch them throw out a lot of people who were the remainers in parliament and bring in a fresh new parliament that was willing to implement Brexit. He set a new Brexit date. They were going to leave the European Union on January 30th of 2020, and they did. They did. And the future was a little uncertain, but they knew with certainty the future in the European Union would be one of decline and further control by people over whom they had no recourse. And so I was actually in Parliament Square with Nigel Farage on the leave night, and what an exciting and historic moment to be there, to see tens of thousands of people turn out in Parliament Square to celebrate their newfound freedom. And I wish the United Kingdom the very best as they step out on their own again, to be a beacon of democracy, of freedom, to make the case for sovereignty, that prosperity, success, safety, and security can be found within the borders of their own country, aligning with partners all around the world, like the US and others who are interested in promoting their success moving forward.
Right. So moving on a little bit another time, you also knew Nancy Reagan for, I think, about a decade after President Reagan's passing. What was that like? And what was it like knowing her as well?
Yeah, it was so interesting because when I worked for President Reagan, obviously I was this very young woman working for her husband, and so had to find a nice way to work with her. And I learned early on there was a couple of things that were important to her. She cared about the truth, and she cared about loyalty. And so I think she knew early on that I would always tell her the truth. I wouldn't sugarcoat it. I wouldn't hide anything from her. I couldn't always solve it or fix it, but I would tell it to her straight. And she knew she had my loyalty and that I was ferociously loyal to her husband. And so beyond that, any little differences we could always work out, because it came back to those two fundamental elements, which was she knew I would tell her the truth and she knew I was incredibly loyal to her and to her husband. And so we had this great working relationship for several years. And of course, as the president announced to the world that he had Alzheimer's, we started working together even more closely just to make sure that he was cared for and comfortable, and that we were aligned in the way that we were handling situations that would come up. And so we did have a great working relationship those years in the office. And then I was extremely grateful to her that once the president left the public eye and those last 5 years of his life when he was at home, she had a very open door policy. And so I could come up and see the president and visit with him. And a lot of times we'd coordinate. So it was a time she was going to be gone for a good part of the day. And so I could go up and sit with the president and spend time with him in those very private behind the scenes moments. And so to be able to finish my service to him and to stay connected to him up until I saw him just a few months before he passed away was very special, because it was more than a professional role. It was very personal. And so to be able to have an open door and to continue that relationship and that connectivity up until the president died was extremely important to me. And I'm so grateful to her for allowing me to do that. And then after he passed away, it became increasingly important to stay connected to her. And she would call every now and then and say, oh, I haven't seen the children in a while. Will you come by? And so to pop by the house and say hello to her and sometimes bring the kids and sometimes visit on my own, but just to remind her that she was somebody that I cared about and was important to me personally, that it wasn't just a job, it was my life. And I was so grateful to her. And I think she loved it, because of course I would come and what would we talk about but our favorite subject, which was her husband. And so she would love it and she would light up, and I would tell her stories, not only from the office years, but I would tell her stories about being out and traveling with the president, times she wasn't there, and ways I got to witness and experience the response people got to him. And, you know, I travel and speak a lot and talk about him. And so to be able to talk about a recent event I was at, and somebody shared a story of their encounter with Ronald Reagan, or how people loved him, or would sit and listen about him and would still cry, you know, she loved that. And so she was always very welcoming, incredibly gracious, and always told me, you know, how proud she was of me and how the president would have been so proud of me. And so those are memories that I take with me to the end of my life. And I was fortunate to see her just a few months before she died as well. And so to bookend 27 years of my life with these incredible people in such a beautiful and very personal way.
So you also got to be in charge of who got to see President Reagan and how the public did interact with him on a, you know, more one-on-one basis. And we were wondering, how did you see the most effective way for people of all ages and backgrounds to be civically engaged and to help out from a grassroots level and up?
Yeah, we tried to, we had a scheduling office, you know, there was a press office, there was a chief of staff. And so a lot of these decisions were made collectively. But as you can imagine, we received big buckets of mail every day, you know, hundreds of people writing in, wanting to have a chance to meet Ronald Reagan. And I think the office in general did a really great job of bringing in a wide range of people, everything from political people who, you know, Mother Teresa, Margaret Thatcher, Gorbachev, we had Lech Walesa from Poland, Chancellor Kohl from Germany, Prime Minister Nakasone, the King of Jordan. I mean, anybody and everybody politically, they came through. We had movie stars come through, but we also had just regular people who loved Ronald Reagan. And usually there was something especially interesting or connective about their letter or their inquiry that made it stand out. But we really tried to bring in a wide variety of people. Some were people from his childhood, and he used to love having people come in who had grown up in Dixon, Illinois, or Tampico, Illinois, or, you know, the Midwest where he came from. And those people would always come in and they'd call him Dutch, because that's what he went by back in the day. And so, hey, Dutch, how you doing? And I knew I had to schedule a little extra time because the storytelling would take place. But to be able to see him engage with everybody from world leaders to ordinary, everyday, patriotic Americans, kids, people who had worked for him in the administration and maybe never had a chance to meet him. There were some beautiful moments. And There's several I write about in the book, but there's a couple that really stand out. One was a little boy who had Asperger's syndrome, which is a form of autism. And he had read every book about Ronald Reagan and was obsessed with Ronald Reagan, and his parents brought him and wrote in and asked to bring him in. And so we brought him in. The parents were very nervous about how this would go, but we assured him it would be fine. And so to watch this beautiful exchange between this man who had stood on the world stage and this little boy who, you know, clearly had some intellectual challenges and disabilities, but to watch that beautiful exchange, you know, Ronald Reagan was one of these people that was writing his legacy of his life with every single day of his life. His legacy wasn't something that was written after he was gone. He was writing it with every single day of his life. And so to see moments like that, to see a war hero that came in and he had been shot down behind enemy lines and had survived for a week by eating bugs and leaves until he was rescued. And the president, Mrs. Reagan, read about him and invited him in to present him with a special award and to watch this beautiful exchange. And then at the end of this meeting, I'll never forget it. And I write about it in my book as well. But these two men go and they're standing in front of the president's desk and they're about to say goodbye. And this young man who had served in the Air Force looked at President Reagan and he said, "I know you're no longer my commander in chief, but I feel like I'd like to salute you. Would that be okay?" And Ronald Reagan looked at him and said, "I know I'm not your commander in chief anymore, but I'd like to salute you back if that's all right." And so the two of them facing each other, saluting each other in this beautiful moment, you know, one young man had so much of life ahead of him. President Reagan obviously had so much of life behind him, but to pay honor and tribute to each other in this beautiful moment, that was the legacy that Ronald Reagan was writing with every single day of his life. And so it really did run the spectrum from kings and queens to the security guards in the building. And to watch him truly enjoy all of those interactions was incredibly special and just proved the heart of the man.
So that is all the time we have for today, but we just want to say thank you to our partners, America's Promise Alliance, Nancy Donahue, and the Greater Lowell Community Foundation. Thank you to all of our listeners and viewers, and thank you especially to Peggy for being with us today, sharing your time and knowledge and all your stories with us.
Great. Thank you. Can I leave you with a quick Reagan quote?
Oh, because of course.
It's one of my favorites. Yeah. It's one of his, and I think it's so timely, especially for today. You know, in 1992, at the Republican National Convention in Houston, it was one of his last final public speeches, and he left us with how he wants to be remembered, and I think it's appropriate even for today. He says, "Whatever else history may say about me when I'm gone, I hope it will record that I appealed to your best hopes, not your worst fears, and to your confidence rather than your doubts." And so much of life today is full of fear and doubt, and I hope we can get back to a place where we're appealing to confidence and best hopes. And Ronald Reagan certainly that inspired that in us, and I'm inspired by watching the future in incredible, capable hands like both of yours. And thank you so much for having me on today.
We hope you enjoyed our discussion with Peggy Grandy.
To learn more about Leaders in Lowell, please check out our website at leadersinlowell.org and our Instagram at leadersinlowellofficial. Our next virtual discussion will feature a talk with Deborah Lee James, the 23rd Secretary of the U.S. Air Force. So please check out our website for more info.
Again, thank you, Peggy, and thank you all for tuning in. We hope to see you again soon.